talk about expanded graphs, where combinatorics and algebra compete and cooperate.
Okay, thank you. So this is supposed to be some kind of a survey, at least that was the excuse, but I'll survey mostly recent work that I was involved in that happened in the last couple of years, these four papers listed there. I'll, of course, give the necessary background, and what I hope to convince you by the end of this is that expansion in graphs, in manifolds, in groups, is an extremely interesting, very diverse phenomena that somehow is just a great playground where lots of different parts of mathematics interact, and you'll see some of it, and I'm sure there's lots more we don't know. So that is my plan. I'll change topics maybe too often in this talk, and so don't worry if you lose me, it will, the next slide will be something else. And please ask questions. So, I mean, even the, you just, so I'm talking about finite graphs here. When you start to think, what does it mean to for the graph to be expanding, different people would describe it in different ways, and you immediately see that these are different parts of mathematics involved in the properties of these graphs. If you think about this combinatorially, as combinatorial property of this graph, then what you would say is that there are no small cuts. You cannot disconnect the graph without removing many edges. You would say it has a high isoperimetric, strong isoperimetric inequality, Poincaré inequality. These are the this combinatorial point of view. If you think about it probabilistically, you can think of the simplest process in which you put a token on some vertex and then start walking randomly to neighbors and then again to neighbors and so on, the simple random walk on this graph, and it's expander if this random walk will converge very quickly to the limiting distribution. So that's a probabilistic point of view of expanders. And algebraic is, again, a very natural one. You can look at the adjacency matrix of the graph and study its eigenvalues, and if you have a big gap between the first eigenvalue and the rest, then it's a good expander. And the really nice effect by what by now we know a lot, started with Chigger and Boozer in the continuous case for manifolds, and then by Tanner, Alon Milman, Alon, Jerome Sintler, and other works I'm not mentioning here, we understand today that all these points of view are really equivalent. And they are not just equivalent qualitatively, there are strong quantitative connections if you parameterize what I mean by rapid or small or high or whatever you see there. When you quantify these as numbers, you get very strong relationship between the parameters in the different points of view. So you can look at them any way you like. They are a very robust object, expanders. And since they are so robust, to define them formally, I can use any point of view, and I'll use the algebraic one. So here's the definition of expanders. I'll define it for undirected regular graphs, graphs of degree D. I'm allowing, by the way, loops, parallel edges, etc. So the best way to think about the graph is simply as a matrix of non-negative integer entries. D-regular means that the row sum and column sum are it's a symmetric matrix. It's an undirected graph. D-regular means that the row sum is D, and in graph terms means every vertex has D edges touching it. And here's the definition. So you define the second largest eigenvalue, lambda of D, which will be the crucial parameter here in this talk. In the following way, you look at the adjacency matrix A sub G. Maybe I'll use this. You look at A sub G, you normalize it by the degree, so it becomes a stochastic matrix. And then you look at the norm of this operator on the space orthogonal to the constant vector. Okay? The constant vector is the eigenvector, of course, with eigenvalue 1, and what you want, and all the other eigenvalues, since I'm taking absolute value, are in the interval 0, 1. And the question is, or the definition is, how small is this lambda of G? It will always be less or equal to 1, and it's an expander if it's much smaller than 1. Now, of course, for one fixed graph, whenever it's connected, it's very easy to see that this lambda will be strictly smaller than one. But what you really want, in order to define expanders, you really need to talk about a family of graphs, an infinite family G sub I. If for all of them you have a fixed upper bound smaller than one on the eigenvalue, then you say that it's an expander family. So that's what we want. The smaller lambda is, the better expander it is. Well, in particular, this an expander in particular is connected. Yeah.
But you, if G is very big, you anyway call this expander. Yes?
Yeah, I anyway call it expander, but of course we will be interested in small g. Yeah. So, Pinsker, this is in the 70s, one of the first applications of the probabilistic method, proved that if you take a random three regular graph, so even if the degree is three, very small, then what you get is an expander. It's very easy to see, simple counting argument. And the big challenge, and even though we know a lot today than we knew 20, 30 years ago, it's still a big challenge, just more refined, I would say, is to construct these graphs explicitly. Now, we had a talk yesterday, actually, by functional analysis, which talks about explicitly constructing matrices. So I feel, as a computer science, I don't have to add to this, but let me add, nevertheless. Explicit is something different in different people's eyes. Some people would like to decide whether it's explicit only after looking at it, and then say, oh. Then I think in complexity theory we have, we offer a definition that's objective. I don't know if it's acceptable, but it's objective. We'd like to be able to construct these objects in polynomial time. For graphs, and particularly these graphs, the usual notion that you are given, let's say, the number n, and you construct a graph on n vertices, which is an expander, let's say three regular, is actually not strong enough. In most applications, and I will not talk too much about it, but in most applications, not all, you want sometimes a stronger definition. You want n to describe the logarithm of the size of the graph. Somehow you want to work with huge graphs like the Boolean cube. Think about the Boolean cube, and what you would like is to be able, whenever you are given a vertex, which is described by n bits, and you want the third neighbor, to be able to tell, to compute what the third neighbor is in polynomial time. That's a stronger definition, and that's what we'll mean by explicit, but it's okay to think even about the weaker definition. The problem is highly non-trivial even there, just to construct an expander on n vertices. So that's the challenge, and just a bit of notation. I'll use the same notation that Noga used, n d lambda, or n d alpha graphs here. So n is the number of vertices, d is the degree, and alpha is an upper bound on the second eigenvalue. It's a number, hopefully less than one. Okay, so since we define, let me just say why it's a challenge. For challenge, the problem has to be interesting. This problem, I think, is so interesting that you may be ruining something by describing all the various areas of application it has. So in computer science, it's just everywhere you go, the randomizing probabilistic algorithm, circuit complexity, lower bounds, error correcting codes. I hope to show you this application in some detail. Communication networks, it's almost obvious that these are great for, maybe substructures for communication networks because they are very robust expanders by their combinatorial definition. Even if you lose some edges, fall or are corrupted, the graph is still highly connected. Other applications I will not discuss here. But actually, I think that more interesting, and maybe for part of this audience, is that there are more and more applications coming out in mathematics, in pure mathematics, for expanding graphs and techniques related to expanding graphs. Perhaps the most a lot of news recently is a work by Gromov, in which he He used expanded graphs to construct manifolds that are counterexamples to the Baum-Kronz conjecture, and maybe people are hoping that it will actually kill also the Novikov conjecture. So they are extremely useful in various aspects of topology. In group theory, the expanders and the techniques related to bounding expansion are useful in generating random group elements. This is both for algorithmic purposes, of course, but also for proving some really interesting theorems in group theory. There are problems like the Rusevich problem, distributing points uniformly on the sphere, on the unitary group, and the optimal result was achieved by Lubotsky, Philipp, Sarnak using the Ramanujan graphs. F-spaces, that's actually related to game theory. They appear everywhere. Of course, in graph theory, you've seen Noga gave a whole talk where these kinds of graphs are useful. I want to just stress that in most of the applications he described, expanders were expanders of very high degree, where the degree is a fixed power of the number of vertices. These are much easier to construct, like finite geometries, etc. Here we mainly concentrate on the bounded degree case. So anyway, expanders are very useful and we want to construct them. And here's the sort of classical method of constructing them. Since we looked at the algebraic definition, they have an algebraic definition, it's very natural to appeal to algebra and try to construct them from algebraic objects. And the most natural ones are, of course, Cayley graphs. Cayley graphs are constructed from groups. So let's say A is a finite group, S is a set of generators for the group. The Cayley graph, C of A and S, is a graph in which the vertices are the group elements, and you connect two vertices, A and A times S, for every generator S in your set of generators. So for having undirected graphs, I'll just look at complementary sets of generators. So whenever you have a group element, you already have its inverse in the generating set. So you have an undirected graph. So these are very natural objects. Here's an example of such a Cayley graph. You can take SL to P, all the 2x2 matrices of determinant 1 with elements in the field, finite field with P elements. Take these generators, M1 and M2, and of course their inverses. This gives you a graph, a family of graphs, one for every P. And here's sort of the end of the challenge. It was not the first solution. I should have mentioned there's this big list, in fact, much longer list of people who constructed explicit expanders and who answered the challenge, starting with Margulis, Gaber Galil, Alon Milman, Lubotsky, Philipp Sarnak, Lubotsky, etc. Lubotsky has shown that this particular family of Cayley graphs is an expander family. So what is the proof? As almost in all algebraic constructions, the proof is very simple if you know some deep theorem in mathematics. And here is this what you do in this case. So you have to prove that an infinite family is expanding. You know, so all these graphs are expanders. That's an infinite number of theorems. You want to prove one theorem and deduce it. And that's how you do it. All these groups are quotients, of course, of SL2Z. And so why not say something about SL2Z? Well, this I already said. You can look at the manifold for which SL2Z is a fundamental group, that's the hyperbolic upper half-plane. And Selberg proved his famous 316 theorem, in which he bounded the first non-zero eigenvalue of the Laplacian, which is basically the eigenvalue gap for this manifold. And once you have this result, you make the connection, you realize that all these finite graphs are good approximation of this infinite manifold, you get that in all of them you have the almost the same eigenvalue gap. So they are all a family of expanders. And in fact, this is a very general tool, this sort of mother group approach, where you prove something for one group and then deduce for all its finite quotients that they are a family of expanders. And in fact, the first result of Margulis, first construction of Margulis was like that. He didn't use Selberg's theorem, he used Kashdan property T. And so this sort of approach works for other groups like SLNZ, which is what he used. Notice it works for any finite generating set of the mother group. It cannot affect this eigenvalue gap by more than a constant, so it will not shrink to zero if you replace one set of generators by another, as long as they are finite. It works also for group actions on sets, etc. And the limit of this approach was the famous Ramanujan graphs that were constructed independently by Margulis and by Lubotsky, Phillips, and Sarnak, in which you get the smallest possible lambda. It's about 1 over square root d. So this algebraic approach sort of has dominated the scene for about 20 years at least for expanded construction. So here's the question. Suppose that I change these generators to two. Is it still a set, or is it still a family of expanders? Notice that when I had one there, these were generators of SL2Z, right? Now, with two there, they don't generate SL2Z anymore, so it's a theorem. So Selberg's theorem suddenly is, does not apply. This is an expander family. Actually, it is, but when I put three here, nobody knows. I mean, of course, these matrices generate SL2P for every P, maybe except for 2 and 3. But so they are good, I mean. So nobody knows. So Weiss and Lubotsky and Weiss wrote a really nice paper about 10 years ago in which they raised all these annoying questions. They basically want to understand whether expansion in Cayley graphs is a property of the group or of the generating set, or also of the generating set. Are some groups so strong that, they will also always be expanding? So, one annoying question, I'm always thinking about a fixed number of generators, let's say 10. Can you find non-expanding generators for this family SL2P? Nobody knows. SN, the symmetric group, it seems to be the opposite side. I mean, nobody has any idea how to come up, even probabilistically, with the constant number of generators for SN.
It is because they are not generated for SA2Z.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so at least the approach doesn't work. Maybe it is. I mean, actually, people believe that it is, that SL2P is always expanding. It doesn't matter what.
The key property of Kashdan is not applicable because you cannot go for SA2Z. So
you can put three there, you can put three there, and Kashdan would not apply if you take the wrong generators. But it seems for all finite graphs it should work. For SN it's the opposite situation. Nobody has any idea whether there exists constant number of generators that will make it expanding. Even probabilistically, non-deterministically, nobody knows whether there exists constant number of generators for SN, which makes it an expander. Open. We know it just for trivial cases, like a billion groups, like ZN, we know that you need non-constant. But that's the only thing we know. So let me just formulate this basic question again. What they asked about 10 years ago, Lubotsky and Weiss, is expansion a group property? So is it possible, or is it the case that whenever you have a sequence of groups, GI, with one set of generators, you make them an expander family, and with another, you don't? Or is it always the same? And one of the papers I mentioned, the one we have with Alon and Lubotsky, answers this in the negative. So expansion is not always a group property. And I hope to explain how it comes about. We don't know it for these questions, but we have examples where it's not, where it depends on the set of generators. And you'll see somehow that for this algebraic technique, we'll need to go through a lot of combinatorics. Let me just point out that the condition that the number of generators is constant is essential for, you know, for making it an interesting question. At least if you allow it to grow, then it's very easy to come up with counterexamples. But even though it's a really simple point, I'll use it later. So let me tell you what this point is. Suppose we allowed many generators, like logarithmic in the size of the group, then a counterexample will be very simple because we could already use a billion groups. So take F2 to the M, so this is just the Boolean cube of dimension M over DF2. When you take it with the generators E1 up to EM, just the unit vectors, okay, it's the graph of the Boolean cube. It's not an expander, it's well known. But on the other hand, if you pick some other, something like 2m, twice the dimension generators, let's say at random, then what you get is, you know, then it's very easy to prove that it is an expander, and that's just a restatement of the fact that this set of vectors, these 2m vectors, generate a good linear code, good error-correcting code of large distance. It's bounding the eigenvalue and bounding the distance is the same because the characters of this abelian group are well understood. So at least for large number of generators.
What is C of F to M?
The Cayley graph of this group with these generators. Okay? This is an abelian group, it's just a vector space.
The statement says that you may choose more elements.
Yeah, so you can take, yeah. So as long as it's not constant, let's say it's logarithmic, both numbers are logarithmic in the...
Prime or not?
Not necessarily. No, any.
Any. So it's not
group. It is a group.
Not field.
Well, I just care about the vector space. There's no multiplication here. Okay, so let me move to the combinatorial side. About 2 years ago, we came up with a way to construct expanding graphs combinatorially, not going through this algebraic methods at all. And it's so simple. I mean, I'll just show it to you and tell you how these expanders are constructing, and then I'll later tell you how it is relevant to this problem of expansion in groups. Okay, let me do this up. So the basis of the combinatorial construction, this is in work with Rangold and Vadan, is the following. It's a new way of composing graphs, which basically preserves expansion. So let me tell you what is needed for this construction. You need two graphs, because it's a graph product. G and H, think of G as a big graph and H as a small graph. And the connection between them should be, notice that the degree of G is M, which is the same as the number of vertices in H. So the small graph has the number of vertices which is equal to the degree of the big graph. And we are going to construct a new graph, G zigzag product H. And it's almost, there's, I guess, only one thing you can do when you have this condition, when the number of vertices in the small graph is the same as the degree of the big graph. You just plant a copy of H in every around every vertex of the big graph G. Okay, so just like depicted here, so let's say H was this 4 cycles, so, and the degree of the big graph was 4, then I plant a copy like this, so all these edges of all these copies are edges of the new graph, and also the old edges of G, they just were truncated near the endpoints. Okay, so you have edges in sort of in these clouds, and you have edges connecting the clouds, which are the original edges of G. So,
specific matching between the...
Thanks for the question. It's not one product. It's a family of products. You can do this in lots of ways. And for everything I'm going to say, it doesn't really matter at all how you do it. You can do it arbitrarily in every vertex. Just any old way will do. Okay? So it's really a family. And the theorem that we proved is that this new graph is an expander if the components G and H were expanded. So if we had some bounds on alpha and beta here, alpha and beta bounds on the eigenvalue of these graphs, which were less than 1, then the eigenvalue, second eigenvalue of the new graph, will also be bounded away from 1. Okay, notice that...
To keep the regularity, don't you have to be careful about it?
I don't care about self-loop, so... I don't, yeah, so it will be regular. I don't care about self loops and parallel edges.
Okay.
So, excuse me? Not here, no, but there are other places where you get them, and actually a different definition of the zigzag product where you get them, but it's, I don't care about them, I allow them.
So for the regular degree D plus 1.
Yeah, this way. So the point is now, notice that, okay, this is an expander, but the amazing thing that happens here is not, well, it's a combination of two things. It is an expander if the two original ones were, but notice that the degree of this graph is just D plus 1. So it just depends on the degree of the small graph. Doesn't matter where, you know, the degree of the big graph could have been enormous. And expanders with enormous degree are easy to construct. And somehow you can shrink this degree down, you can pull it down, and not affect expansion by much. That's really the power of this product. And of course, so let me repeat, G zigzag H is an expander if G and H are, and this immediately leads to this combinatorial construction of expanders that I'll show you.
I want to add to this construction of zigzag is, which you know, Grom.
Yes.
It was before him in
18. In fact, it was even before Gromov.
Yes.
It's even, people have used this, people have used this, you know, construction.
He introduces exactly for studying for Bayesian values.
That's right.
He didn't have this
here. That's right. That's right.
And it's a beautiful cube.
Absolutely. What Gromov has done. Yeah. Yeah. He got almost constant degree. He got log star degree, something like this. That's right. And people in actually in networks were using this construction a lot. Here, let me look at this graph, which is. I mean, that's more or less the beginning of what Gromov did and what people in networking did. This just explains the construction. So it's an example. If G is a big graph, is a Boolean cube, non-constant degree, and H is the cycle of length M, same as the dimension, then when you plant the cycles around every vertex, that's the graph you get. It even has a name because it was used in the construction of parallel computers, a cube-connected cycle. And yeah, basically what was missing is this bound on the eigenvalue.
You still need some starting graph.
Very good. So let's do the construction. So hopefully this zigzag is fine. Yeah, so we need some starting graph. That is leading us ahead to the next slide. So before I do this, so let me show you, now that we have this product, how we do the construction, but let me... just before and say that I'll use a slightly stronger product, which I will not define, but is similar to this. It's more or less the cube power of this construction. And that was actually the one we had originally, in which the bound on the new eigenvalue is better than there. Here I didn't specify what F was. It just depended on the other two numbers. Okay. So I'm using a zigzag prime that I'm not defining, but has similar properties. Again, the number of vertices is a product. The degree is not D plus 1, but D squared, still a function of the degree of the small one. Does not depend on the big one at all. And the eigenvalue bound is at most alpha plus beta. So it's an explicit bound that I will use. Okay, and let me say something about the proof of this theorem. So not only is the construction simple, In another talk, I could have spent about 20 minutes and given you the complete proof of why this is an expander if the small ones are. First of all, it has a very simple intuition guiding it. There is a reason why it happens. And translating this reason to the necessary linear algebra is half a page. Okay, so it's really, really simple. Okay, so how do we use it to construct...
alpha and beta were supposed to be less than 1.
Yeah, they are less than 1. Well, I'll use...
alpha plus beta is not necessary.
Well, I'll make them even smaller. I'll make them less than a half. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'll just need this. You are right, you are right that this does not guarantee expansion in general. And you can certainly take the maximum of this and this F. Yeah, but I will not need anything more than that. So here's the construction. So we start, as Lati said, with some fixed expander. I need one constant size expander. Let's say D is 100. I need a graph with degree 100, number of vertices 100 to the fourth, and eigenvalue bound 1/4. Okay? You may ask where I'm taking this graph from, because even constructing such a graph may be a problem. It's much easier than an infinite family, but there are several answers. One would be, you know, enumerate them all. They're only a constant number. you could do another, actually better one, is just draw one at random and check it. It's very easy to check. And if it doesn't work, do another one. It will work for sure. But just to be on the safe side, we have explicit constructions of these. They are very simple, related to finite geometries. You see, it's really easy because the number of vertices is just the power of the degree. So it's really easy. So you start with one like this, and from this you generate an infinite family. By iteration, here are all the graphs in the family. The first one is the square of H, and every next one, GK plus 1, is obtained by squaring the previous one. Squaring in the sense of squaring the adjacency matrix. So taking parts of length 2, if you will. Squaring, and then taking this zigzag prime product with H.
So the squaring is to reduce the alpha.
Exactly. So let's just, here is the proof, it's two lines. So the claim is that this family, GK, the sizes are growing, it's D to the 4K, all of them are regular of degree D squared. And the eigenvalue bound in all of them is 1/2. Okay, so let's see why it works. Assume it's for GK. When we square it, like Keith said, number of vertices remain. The degree goes up, it squares from D squared to D to the fourth. The eigenvalue, all eigenvalues square, so in particular the bound goes down to 1/4. And notice we are in position because the degree here is D to the fourth, which is the number of vertices in H, to use the zigzag product, so we use it. And we have this bound 1/4 there. What we get is a reduction of the degree back to D squared. Okay? And eigenvalue 1/2. Just repeat. So that's the whole story for constructing these expanders. And you can, of course, prove that they are explicit in the sense that I mentioned before. And so, you know, it gives a very good feeling that in a combinatorial way we were able to achieve something that was done by deep algebra. But actually that alone may not be so satisfactory. I want to, by the way, are there questions about the...
In which sense are they explicit?
They're explicit in the sense that in this graph, let's say n is a parameter that describes the length of the encoding of a vertex, or logarithm of the size of the graph. If you give a name of a vertex, and you give a direction, one of the edges in which you want to go, then you can compute easily the name of the vertex you reach, the other side of the edge. Yeah. And this is used in... Yeah. And it's much easier to see that it's explicit in the usual sense, that just to construct a graph on n vertices like this is... polynomial time. But actually, it's much better than that, than just doing what you could do with algebra, because I told you in the beginning that all these notions of expansion were tightly connected by good quantitative bounds. But nevertheless, in many theoretical or practical applications, what you want to optimize, you have extremal problems related to expansion that... where you want to get the best parameters possible. And sometimes it's not through the eigenvalue that you get them. So let me give you two examples. So in both examples, think of A as a large constant. Okay? Let me just... Think of A as a large constant. Here's one possible optimization problem. You want an n-d graph on n vertices, degree d, in which every two sets of size n over a, so constant proportion, will have an edge connecting one vertex here and one vertex here. It's a strong notion of expansion that actually is useful in lots of constructions, like superconcentrators, like sorting in rounds, many combinatorial applications. What you want is to have the smallest degree possible given this condition. Okay, and you want it explicit, of course. If you take the bounds you get for this parameter from Ramanujan graphs, the bound you get is that the degree is something like quadratic in A, in this parameter A. If you use only eigenvalues, that's right. But it's certainly not optimal, because if you take a random graph and you just calculate what the degree should be, you see that A log A should suffice. And it turns out that using this zigzag product construction, like I defined, but not doing induction, not looking at the parameter of the eigenvalue, which we did here, but looking at this particular expansion parameter, then you can get the degree, again, explicit graphs of degree, which are very close to what you get in the random graphs, and much better than the eigenvalue bound, what it implies. And actually, it's this zigzag product needs to be extended to another type of objects that are called extractors that I will not talk about. I highly recommend everybody to find out about them, because they are as wonderful as expanders. But I will not have time to talk about them. And I should say that also for this expansion, you need to work with, of course, a different norm, not the L2 norm. And the norm needed, which actually came out from work on extractors, is some kind of mixed norm where you look at the L-infinity entropy. You want to see how it increases, but this is not quite strong enough, so you need to use the mixed norm where you look at L1 distance to to L-infinity entropy. And that's the notion of expansion you use there. So here is another task that you may be interested in. And again, it's a specific expansion task, a very natural one, maybe the most natural of all, is the basic isoperimetric inequality for vertices. So what do you want? You want, again, you have this parameter A. You want a graph of n vertices degree d, and you want every set of size n over a, this constant fraction, to expand by as much as possible, by some c which is as large as possible given the degree. Okay? Well, certainly it cannot be larger than d, because every vertex has just d neighbors. If you use Ramanujan graphs, again, from the eigenvalue bound, you get just d over 2. In fact, the trivial way would be d over 4, but Kahale showed that actually you can get expansion d over 2 from Ramanujan graphs. But he also showed that Ramanujan graphs, he constructed Ramanujan graphs for which it's no better than d over 2. Actually, for computer science, for computer scientists, it's very weird to be interested in differences like between d and d over 2. Usually we care nothing about much bigger factors. However, it's amazing. This gap, this factor of 2, is a killer for like about 5 different applications. And I'll show you one. Somehow it's a whole new ball game to beat d over 2. And you'll see in a second why. Of course, random graphs beat it. I mean, in random graphs, the expansion is almost optimal. It's very close to d. It's only 1 minus epsilon d, which are called lossless expanders. By the way, lossless really means that if you think about the entropy growth on the graph, when you take a random walk, you are in some set, or let's say of size n over a, let's say you are uniform there, and then you take a random step, you have d vertices, so you have log d randomness that you are adding, and in this log d randomness, you don't want to lose a single bit. Notice that when it's d over 2, you are losing a bit. Seems like a little, but you don't want to lose a single bit. You are willing to lose just a fraction, tiny fraction of a bit. Yes, Prasad. Yeah. So, it's polynomial. Polynomial. Yeah. But for now, we are talking about constants. So. But there is a polynomial dependency. And what we do, again, in this new work, this is the most recent one with Kapal, Borangel, and Vadan, is construct explicitly such graphs in which you achieve a lossless expansion. Okay? And again, this uses another variant of zigzag product, and you need to apply to even stranger constructs called conductors, and which I will not describe, but actually this result not only works for graphs, but works for unbalanced bipartite graphs, and for the application I want to show you, I will use unbalanced bipartite graphs. So let me show you this applications. Again, any questions? So, here's an extremely basic problem. It was formulated by Shannon 50 years ago and was basically resolved to for many practical purposes, but not completely over the last 30 years maybe. And it's a question of constructing efficient, explicit and efficient error-correcting codes. What is the problem of error-correcting codes? I'm talking to you here, and somehow there is noise in the room, and you know about 10% of what I'm saying is lost, or is flipped randomly, and you still want to understand me, not to mention my Israeli accent that is adding to the problem. So a solution to this basic communication problem, which is a serious one, is to send, for the sender of messages to actually encode them, to add redundancy to the message, so that even if some parts are corrupted, but a small part is corrupted, the receiver can efficiently decode, figure out what was sent, as long as not too many errors are introduced in the process. And you want to do this in such a way that the redundancy is not much. It's a constant factor. And here's the simplest solution that I think exists today. Everything was basically known. The idea is to construct expanding graphs from codes from expanding graphs. It goes back to Gallagher in the mid-60s. He constructed them from random graphs, and then ideas of Tanner and Sipser-Spielman relating them to expanding graphs. And in all cases, the algorithms are quite complicated because such graphs were not known, which are lossless expanders. But let me show you that if you have lossless expanders, which by now we do, how you get these codes extremely simply. And I'll not only describe the codes, which are simple, but the decoding algorithm, getting this. It's a nonlinear problem. You have to remember when you get somebody corrupt some fixed percentage of what you got, it's a nonlinear problem to recover the correct message, but it's extremely simple if you have this graph. So let me show you how. So let me first define the code. We start from one of these lossless expanders. So I take one of them, which we have, and it's an unbalanced bipartite graph. We have n vertices in the bottom and n over 2 in the top. And the way you should think about the top vertices as linear equations, okay? Linear equations, parity checks. This is all modulo 2. And the graph is lossless. All I need is, let's say, that the bottom degree is 10, and every set of at most n over 100, 1% expands by a factor of 9. It's almost 10. And you would see that if it was 5, it would not do. It just wouldn't work. You need this almost lossless expansion. So you take one of these graphs, and what is the code? The code is, where is the code? Here's the code. So the code is simply a linear subspace. It's just all vectors in the bottom that satisfy all these linear equations. When you apply these linear equations, you get zero at the top. So it's a subspace of dimension n over 2. So to encode, you would just take a message which is n over 2 bits and do the inverse of this transformation. So add the other n over 2 redundant bits so that you have such a vector. And that's encoding is always, it's just a linear. Encoding is linear, so it's always efficient. The rate of this code is a half. As I said, there are n over 2 real information bits and n over 2 redundant ones. Yeah?
What you're checking on is that the sum of the degrees is 0 more
than not the sum of the degrees, the sum of the input, sum of your neighbors. Every top guy checks that. So every element of the subspace is a legitimate code word. And now you have to imagine that I'm sending you one of these guys, and some adversary corrupts, in this case, half a percent of these bits, flips them arbitrarily. And that's what you get. How would you recover the original code word? And it's extremely simple. I mean, you behave greedily and it works. So here's what you do. Yeah. So here's the decoding algorithm. It goes by phases, yeah?
The code that you mentioned over two, you mean that those quality checkers are now independent?
Yeah, it's even better if they are not, but in the West, yeah.
Exactly about what I mentioned.
Yeah, you don't need to. It's only at least, the rate is at least a half. Yeah, that's right. But in fact, they will be independent. Okay, so here's what you do. So here is the error set. Of course, we don't know it. This half a percent of errors, these bits were flipped. Because they were flipped, when you evaluate these parity checks, some of them will not be zero, some of them will be one.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just defining it. I'm just saying the brown set is the error set. Okay, here I didn't get to the algorithm. I'm telling you what this is now. Okay. Oops. Yeah. I should stand here. So this is the error set. Somebody flipped these bits. We don't know what they are, but somebody did that. Here's how we correct errors. We have the message. And we evaluate these parity checks, and some values are 1. Now, every vertex down there wants to know whether his value is the bit, you know, there is correct or incorrect. Do it greedily. Look at your neighbors and see whether more than half are 1s or less than half are 1s. If more than half are 1s, you think, boy, I must be wrong. I have to flip my value. Okay? And that's what each of them does in parallel. What is the rationale? In such a strongly expanding graph, you know, lossless graph, almost all your neighbors are only your neighbors if you come from such a small set. Okay? So, almost all guys deciding this way will not make a mistake. That's the basic point. And you can argue that, you know, from this set, most guys that will flip are, you know, should have flipped, so you will kill about 3/4 of the bad errors. Of course, you are generating new errors, maybe. But you can also bound this by a quarter. So it's a very simple argument that the size of the error set shrinks by a half in logarithmic number of iterations. They're actually just linear time of work because it's geometrically decreasing. You will have recovered the code work. So that's, you know, an example of an application of these wonderful graphs, and there are many more, as I said. So let me go back in the last...
Yeah, you needed your neighbors from down...
Yeah, we needed, yeah, this unbalance. We really needed that the size here is smaller, otherwise we would have zero rate.
Is the argument the same if some of the parity checks get flipped?
Of course they get flipped. I mean, the parity check, the values there... Yeah, they are not sent. No. Just the bottom ones are sent. These are just equations. You calculate their value as you go along. Okay, so the last 15 minutes, let me... did all my slides go? So now we are back to algebra. Okay, so, you know, we thought 2 years ago that we have invented something new, combinatorial, new graph product, but then, in fact, in several talks that I gave about this work 2 years ago, about the zigzag product, people, mathematicians in the audience came to me after the talk and told me, you know, it looks really very similar to semi-direct product in groups. But of course I paid no attention until Alex Lubotsky really forced me to, so. Here's the point. So there's a very, well-known standard graph operation, group operation, group semi-direct product of groups. It's It's actually a way to get all groups from all simple groups. It's a very simple construction. It's just a twist on the direct product of groups, but of course much more powerful because you can generate non-abelian groups from abelian ones. Here is the operation. For this you need two groups, A and B. Again, think of A as a big one, B as a small one. And what you need is an action. B acts on A. Okay, you need an action. Let me denote A to the power B, the action of B on A. And now, when the semi-direct product of these two groups is all pairs, like, in direct product. But the group multiplication is a little bit different. So on the right component, so you have these pairs A, B, and A hat, B hat. In the right component, you simply multiply the elements. In the left component, because you have action, you first act with B on A hat, and later you multiply. Okay, that's the twist. That's actually called the twist. Okay, so this is old and well known, and as it turns out, semi-direct product in groups turns out to be a special case of the zigzag product. Okay, when some conditions apply, of course for the appropriate Cayley graphs, when some conditions apply, then you can really think of zigzag as a generalization of this to much larger set of combinatorial objects, namely graphs. Okay, so what do you need? What is the extra condition you need? Assume that you have generators for these groups A and B. So T for B and S for A. And further, and that's the important thing, assume that S is a single orbit under the action of B. So we have this action. So the generators for A, which may be a large set, are a single orbit generated by one single element, little s, and the action of B. Okay? It moves you, takes you to the whole generating set of A. Suppose you have that. Then, these two objects are the same, so let me say what is the left and what is the right. On the left, you have the semi-direct, you have the Cayley graph, where the group is a semi-direct product. You take all generators of B and only one generator of, just this single element S from the generating set of A. That's what you usually do when you do semi-direct product. Semi-direct product partly was invented to reduce the number of generators. Okay, so you see the number of generators is D plus 1. It's just D from B and 1 plus from A. The graph you get here is exactly the same graph, and here you have to worry about how you embed the little graphs in the big graphs. You have to, it's obvious how to, but that's what you do. This graph is exactly the same as the zigzag product of the Cayley graph of A with S, with all the generators, and B with T. Okay? And it's not more than an observation. I mean, if you just look at the construction here, and you think what happens, then when you take an arbitrary element in the group AB and multiply it by 1T, namely a generator from the small one, then all you are doing is moving to a neighbor in a cloud in this orange thing. And what happens when you multiply it by S1, which is the only guy you took from the generating set of A, because of the twist, you will move, so nothing will happen in the right coordinate, and you'll move to the neighboring cloud, just as you do in zigzag. That's the whole proof. It's a simple observation. So why is it useful? Well, it's useful because now we can apply this, the fact that we have eigenvalue, that we have the zigzag generates expanders from expanders. We can use it in the context of Cayley graphs, in the algebraic context. Let me just before give you an example, which I already had beforehand, if I can find it. Maybe I should have raised this question before, although I'm sure people would know. Is this a Cayley graph of a group? Yeah, everybody knows. I see some people nodding. It's a Cayley graph of this group. I mean, after all, when we did this construction, G was actually a Cayley graph of the abelian group, right? This cube is an abelian group. H is a cyclic group. And indeed, this graph is just what you get from semi-direct product of these two groups, where the generators you take are the... Of course, we have an action let me add, we have an obvious action. The cyclic group acts on the coordinates of the vector space, just shift them. Okay, so we get we have an action, so we get that this is in fact a zigzag product of G and H, and the generators are just whatever, a shift and a unit vector in one arbitrary unit vector for the large group A. So it went down to degree 3. Let me just say that, okay, so I meant to explain, how much time do I have?
5-6 minutes.
Okay, so let me just say in 1 minute, I meant to explain how to get from this the counter example for the fact that expansion is not a group property. I'll not go into this, I'll just say the idea is that, you know, like in zigzag, we can take a counterexample which has a high degree, which I already showed you in the abelian case for this group, okay, and push the degree down using zigzag or using semi-direct product. So you can push the degree down to a constant exactly using this kind of trick. The one thing missing, though, is that I told you that there are the set of generators for the vector space, F2 to the M, like 2M vectors, which make it an expander. And I said there are random ones. This is not enough because we need that the generating set will be an orbit under an action of the small group. Now, of course, a random set is not the orbit of anything. The first observation is you don't really need one orbit. A fixed number of orbits will do. All you get is instead of degree d plus 1, you get d plus a number of orbits. So it's still small. And the second thing you need is something, a theorem like that, saying that you can make even the Boolean cube an expander, not just with 2m random vectors, but actually with 2 random vectors and all their shifts. And that's, in this case, it's not so hard to prove, but I want to tell you that it's actually a special case of a theorem with Meshulam and some other consequences of this. So using this and, you know, playing with it, we got the example, which is a strange group in which expansion does depend on the choice of generators. But now that we have means to take Cayley graphs, small Cayley graphs, and make from them bigger Cayley graphs that are also expanding, we can hope of maybe generating not just a sequence of expanders, but actually an infinite sequence of Cayley expanders in groups in combinatorial-like fashion. And we are not quite there, because the result I'll describe to you in this work with Meshulam is certainly not satisfactory. A, the graphs are not explicit. B, they don't have constant degree. So there's lots more to do, but it's still extremely interesting. What's interesting to me there is expansion ties up with other parameters, other interesting parameters of the group. And so let me tell you what they are. So here's the idea of this iterative construction that doesn't quite make it. So, like the cyclic group acts on the coordinates of the vector space, in general you can take a vector space in which the coordinates are labeled by any group. This is just the group algebra, FQG, other prime. The group acts naturally on the coordinates, just like there. And here's the idea. So, suppose we already constructed G and generators which make it expanding. We can try to take the semi-direct product. At least we know we have an action. So we can try to take semi-direct product with the group algebra, which is an abelian group, and it will expand. If it did, then we can repeat this process. Okay, so that would be the idea. And we know from the previous, I mean, from this zigzag theorem and its connection with semi-direct products, that all we need is that in this action, under this action, we can find a constant number of generating, a constant number of orbits which generate this group algebra as an expander. Okay, like I told you, there are 2 vectors that with all their shifts you get an expander in the cube. And it turns out that there is a group theoretic condition, a representation theoretic condition, which implies this. This is the first theorem that we prove. Actually, when you start trying to see what this means, well, when do you have such a constant number of expanding orbits, then you get immediately to the ranks of elements in the group algebra, and then you immediately get to the number of representations, irreducible representations of the group. So it turns out that this first theorem is that if the growth of the number of irreducible representations of dimension D grows exponentially, only exponentially with D, okay, like unlike in abelian groups where all of them are one, then you will have this constant number of orbits. Okay, that's the first theorem. The next one is what you would like is that it suffices that the group has a constant number of expanding generators, the group itself, not the group algebra. If it's expanding with a constant number of generators, you already have this representation theoretic condition holding. It turns out, unfortunately, that this is not quite a theorem.
What is it, G1, that you wrote at most?
At most, yes. So you don't have too many representations of low dimensions. Like in SL2P, all representations, except the trivial one, are dimension, you know, P.
It's the other way around, right? It's much slower. It's rather like Bobbia.
Excuse me?
For the symmetric group, for example, it's much slower than...
For the symmetric group, you definitely have this condition.
Right.
So yes? But
much stronger.
That's right. Yeah, that's all that is needed. What I'm writing here, theorem 1 says that if you have this condition, then you can generate the group algebra with a constant number of orbits. This, by the way, is a probabilistic argument. We don't know how to get them explicitly. You pick random ones and they work with high probability.
But do you know that this is necessary? Because this comes from the algebra.
Yeah, so it's... Not completely. The relation is strong, but it's not complete. Yeah. Actually, I didn't specify here, and probably one should, over which field you want these representations. For the first theorem, you take over FQ. For the second theorem, actually, I'm talking about complex representation, so it's even stronger. But as I said, it's not a theorem. You need this, at least, as far as we know, it doesn't work for all groups. We know how to prove it for monomial groups and actually a larger class of solvable groups, but not for all groups. And luckily, just for this iterative construction to succeed, when you start with a monomial group, what you get at the end is a monomial group. So indeed, this is, it leads to this iterative construction that's spelled out here, in which, which says just what I said. You start from an arbitrary group. Now, luckily, the object you start with is trivial to construct. You start with any group. I mean, Z2 or Z3 or whatever, with any generator. Then you just iterate this process. You take the group algebra and take the zigzag product with it. And for generators, you take the old generators plus the constant number of orbits which exist by this theorem. And the outcome is this sequence of Cayley graphs in which they are all expanding, but the number of generators, as I said, is not a constant. It's growing very slowly to infinity. The number of generators for the nth one, for the nth group, is something like the iterated logarithm, log, 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 n over 2 times of the size of the group. But it's not constant. And in fact, it cannot be constant, because these are solvable groups, and the length of the central series is n for the nth group, and it's a theorem that you cannot have better than, you cannot have a number of generators less than log, 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 n times of the size of the group. So it's essentially optimal. Anyway, this is what we know so far. It would be nice to solve all these problems and others. I think it would be really interesting to find different ways of generating expanding Cayley graphs of constant degree. It would be really interesting to find this generating orbits explicitly, which even in the case of the cyclic group, we don't really know. It's very interesting from the coding theory perspective. This question, whether, how tight is the connection between expansion and the growth of dimensions of irreducible representations, I find very interesting. It's also related to the growth of the number of subgroups of a given index. If you replace D by D squared in the exponent, then it's known. Unfortunately, it's not useful for the theorems I discussed. And, you know, is expansion a group property for at least some groups, like these really interesting examples? That's it. No, the algorithm has to be completely different. If you don't have lossless expansion, then you cannot use this naive majority, you know, greedy algorithm. You need to construct, actually, different graphs, at least the best known. I mean, suddenly this would not work, and there have been constructions that bypass this problem. I should have pointed out when the expansion is just d over 2, it's possible that all the neighbors have 2. You know, every parity check is actually knows 2 input symbols, and then you don't have even a single unique guy that will tell you that it's only yours. So anyway, you need to go to a more complex algorithm. Also, in terms of bounds, the best theoretical bounds on how much you can correct are from the lossless expanders. You get to the Zyablov bound. I don't know if you know it. Anyway, so.
But actually, I don't think
that's
really lossless. Just to be a bit about the
yeah, in fact, for a sequential algorithm, not a parallel like this, you need one unique neighbor. Just for a bound on the distance, you need d over 2 plus 1, just for a bound on the distance. For correcting these many errors, you need a constant fraction more. Yeah.
So why is it so important that the degree is a constant?
You pay for each edge. That's the reason, in dollars. So, so I mean, yeah, that's the simplest answer. It's you know, in most of the applications of this type of graphs are in communication networks, and there just you want to minimize the hardware cost.
Questions? So if not, let's thank speaker.